Welcome back. It is that special Friday every month. It is time for Ask the Author with Donna Gould from Village Voices and Village of the Arts. And her guest this month is Sonia Pressman Fuentes, author of Eat First. You don't know what they'll give you. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Hi, I'm Donna Lee. Thank you for having us.
Always. I love having the book. I love having the authors in. I brought this author, Dan Rubin, in and he never left.
Hi, Dan. Okay, tonight we have Sonia Pressman Fuentes with Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You. And Sonia is the one of the founding members of NOW. And when I read her book, I really, really enjoyed it. The beginning was about her parents coming to this country from Germany through Poland. They got here to America, and then it was about her family and her relationship with them growing throughout her life. It was actually a complete biography. I loved that she drifted from one career idea to another, but when she made up her mind, it was look out. She took off on her own to start a new life, and in that era, it was a true testament of her strength. Sonia, I admired your stick-to-your-guns mindset and wondered where and when you gained this character trait.
I have no idea. I think that my confidence came from my parents' unconditional love for me. But beyond that, I think it was just a process of growing up and deciding what I wanted to do, which was never easy. And then once I decided, that was it.
Your parents' unconditional love was really obvious when I loved your dad. That scene when he came down to Miami to get you a car and 2 weeks later bought a house. Go ahead and tell me a little bit about what happened there and tell the audience.
Well, my parents did not want me to go to college or law school because they were traditional Jewish people from a village in Poland, no education. And what they knew was that a young woman should get married and raise a family when she turned 18. And they, therefore, did not want me to go to college or law school because they felt that would keep me from being a suitable marriage prospect. But although they were totally opposed to my going to college and law school, they paid for me to go to college and they paid for me to go to law school. And at the time I went to law school, I was living in Long Beach, New York, with my parents. And I went off to law school on my own. And I had $1,500 with me and figured that was enough to get me through the first year. And I had no idea what I would do after that. But I wrote to my parents, and in one letter I wrote them that I was having some difficulty getting around campus and buying groceries because I didn't have a car. And my mother read that letter to my father. He could not read or write English. And he didn't say anything, but he went into the next room. And my mother followed him and saw that he was packing a bag. So she said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Didn't you hear that letter?" And she said, "Yes, what about it?" And he said, "The girl needs a car. I have to go down and buy her a car." So my mother said, "What are you talking about? It's the night before Rosh Hashanah, which is an anniversary. We're starting Rosh Hashanah in a few days." And my father just kept packing. And he took a train down to Miami Beach and called me at the University of Miami Law School. And I said, "Hi, who is this?" And he said, "It's your dad." And my dad had never called me before. And in person, he had a strong Jewish accent. But on the phone, he did not. So I said, "This is not my dad. My dad's in Long Beach. Who are you?" And he said, "It's your dad." And I said, "Is this Hal?" That's a guy I'd been dating in Connecticut, and he was the type that could have come down to Miami Beach. He said, "No, this is your father." I said, "Well, if you're my father, what's my Jewish name?" And he said, "Scheindel." And I said, "Hi, Dad."
It was like a password.
So he bought me a car, and then I took him to see the dorm where I was staying. And I was put in a dorm or offered a dorm with three other women. And they were not going to law school. They were going to undergraduate school. One of them never went to school. She to classes. She was just there to meet boys. And one of them was my roommate, and she looked fine when I met her. But it turned out she had some sort of mental disturbance, because one morning I woke up and she was screaming at me because her hairbrush wasn't the same in the same place on the dresser that had been the night before, and she claimed I had moved her hairbrush. So I took to sleeping on the floor of the living room so as not to run into that problem. So when my father came to visit, he saw that I was sleeping on the floor of the living room. He didn't say anything. He went home, and he said to my mother, "We have to move to Florida." And she said, "Why is that?" And he said, "Because the girl is sleeping on the floor. We have to buy a house so she can live with us while she goes to law school, which we don't want her to go to." So my brother happened to be a realtor. So they gave their home in Long Beach to my brother to sell. And within 2 weeks, they were in North Miami Beach in a new house, and I moved in with them.
Which I thought that was incredible that he believed in you that much. Even though it was against what he thought was right,
he didn't believe in me. He loved me. Okay. I don't know that he believed in me.
Yeah, they were not thrilled with your graduate-level education, going on through graduate-level education, were they?
Absolutely not.
And your brother in particular.
Well, my brother was very funny because he was more old-fashioned than my parents, having grown up in Germany. And so when I said that I was going to law school, and he always tried to act like a father to me because he was 14 years my senior. And I always told him, "I have a father. You're not it."
Hurt his feelings.
When I was home before going to law school, he came to our house one day and began to rant and rave about why I shouldn't be going to law school. He must have done that for an hour or two. It meant absolutely nothing to me. He left. I packed my bags and I went.
Now, you were one of the first women to graduate law school. Not the first, there was a very small percentage of women in law school at the time you were going.
When I graduated in 1957, 3% of the law school graduates in this country were women.
And my understanding is now women outnumber men in law school.
In law school, it's about 50-50, or they outnumber them. That is correct.
Yeah, they're starting to take the edge, is my understanding. And I hate to say it, it's not really a race, but we've come a long way. I mean, that's 50 years. We've come from just 3% to over 50% of women.
But that actually applies, I think, across the board to all studies. Women are outpacing men with graduating from college with masters and PhDs.
And that's an awesome thing. And it is thanks to people like Sonia.
You
were really a trailblazer in a lot of industries, a lot of your jobs. You were the first woman hired. One of the stories I loved the most was you were the first woman in the executive lunchroom at one of your companies.
Yeah, at GTE Service Corporation. That is true.
And that was a big deal.
I didn't think it was such a big deal, but they thought it was a big
deal. To them it was.
Right.
Were you uncomfortable being the only woman in an all-male executive lunchroom?
I wasn't uncomfortable at GTE, but except that we formed a group there of women who wanted to get ahead, were feminists and so on, and we kept it secret. We thought we had to keep it secret. But beyond that, and we probably did, and beyond that, I don't think I was uncomfortable there. I was more uncomfortable at my next corporate job, TRW Inc., because I felt that I was the only one who felt as I did there. And when I left that company, I said to myself that I never again want to be in a place where I'm the only one who feels the way I feel. And I never have been again. But I had also a more sensitive position at TRW. I was in charge of equal employment opportunity and affirmative action.
And an appropriate place for you to be. We actually have to wrap it up, but tell our listeners where they can find your book.
They have to order my book online, and they can get it from Amazon.com or my publisher, XLibris.com, which is spelled XLIBRIS, or BarnesandNoble.com. It's available in hard copy, soft cover, and for Kindle.
Sonia, thank you so much for coming in. And Donna, let us know, who's our next Ask the Author guest?
Next month, we have Judith Rock, and she has a series of historical novels based in France, the Charles de Luc series, and we will be talking to her. Her new book comes out October 2nd, and we'll talk to her on that and her earlier books in the series.
And the first two books are The Rhetoric of Death and The Eloquence of Blood, and then the third one in this series, like you said, is coming out October 2nd, so we'll get to talk to Judith right around the time that third book hits the street.
And they're historical mysteries.
I'm looking forward to it. I just got my copy to read. I'm so excited. Sonia, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time. And we appreciate you coming up here in Rainpocalypse. It was beautiful all day. And then everybody's coming to the studio and it just downpoured everywhere. So we really, really appreciate you coming up and dealing with the rain and muck and mire and mess and bad traffic that's out there.
A pleasure to be with all of you.
Thank you. And Donna, thank you. We'll see you next month.
We will.
Folks, we're going to take a short break and then we'll be back with Mike LaMond and Dan Rubin.